Ukraine aid passes the U.S. House of Representatives.
It is a historical moment, which took actually longer than it should, but the fact that it passes got a lot of, I would say, pure joy and happiness.
Plus, fighting in Gaza continues as Passover starts in Israel.
Which is the, you know, holiday of freedom. And, you know, you had all of these relatives of hostages speaking, and their life is just, you know, awful, and they just are so sad.
And later, reaction from Kyiv to the passage of the Ukrainian aid bill, and a look at how Pakistan is fighting climate change and bringing in millions of dollars. Today is Monday, April 22nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. We'll start today in Washington, where over the weekend, the House of Representatives passed funding bills for Ukraine, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, as well as funding for other domestic priorities. House Speaker Mike Johnson faced down threats to oust him on Saturday, saying, "We did our work here, and I think history will judge it well." This after the U.S. House of Representatives, with broad bipartisan support, passed a $95 billion aid package over bitter objections from Republican hardliners. The vote on passage of the Ukraine funding was 311 to 112. But significantly, 112 Republicans opposed the legislation, with only 101 in support. Far-right Republican representatives have threatened to remove Johnson from office over the issue. When asked about the possibility of losing his job, Johnson said,
"As I've said many times, I don't walk around this building being worried about a motion to vacate. I have to do my job. We did. I've done here what I believe to be the right thing, and that is to allow the House to work its will. And as I've said, you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may."
The legislation now proceeds to the Democratic Majority Senate, which passed a similar measure more than 2 months ago. The Senate is expected to pass the bill, and President Biden is expected to sign it into law. For a closer look at some of the nuts and bolts of the bill, here is VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
Funding for Ukraine's war against invading Russia. Israel's war on Hamas in Palestinian territories, and support for Taiwan's military against a possible attack from China. The United States House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted to provide a total $95 billion in foreign aid this weekend in surprisingly bipartisan fashion for a Congress that's been bitterly divided along party lines. The vote was Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's first major test leading his party's razor-thin majority.
"I've said it very simply. I'll say it once again. It's an old military adage, but we would rather send bullets to the conflict overseas than our own boys, our troops. And I think this is an important moment, an important opportunity to make that decision. We allowed the House to do that, and I expect the Senate will make the same decision."
Johnson secured the necessary votes only by reaching across the aisle for help from House Democrats. Two hard right members of Johnson's conference threatened his ouster if he followed through with the Ukraine aid vote. Johnson's allies credit his fortitude in the face of rebellion.
"I am so proud of the Speaker Mike Johnson. He went through a transformation. At the end of the day, profile and courage is putting the nation above yourself. And that's what he did. He said at the end of the day, I'm going to be on the right side of history, irrespective of my job. And I think that was what I admired so much."
One of the biggest sticking points for many Republicans was future funding for Ukraine. That country's leadership has been pleading with Western powers for material support in its war against invading Russia since the onset in February 2022. With the House passing its foreign aid package, Ukraine's president was quick to thank lawmakers and the American people.
"This aid will strengthen Ukraine and send the Kremlin a powerful signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan. The United States will stay with Ukraine, will protect the Ukrainians, and they will protect, they'll protect democracy."
The bill contains $60 billion in aid for Kyiv now in its third year of war with Moscow. It includes $26 billion for Israel's war effort against Hamas, as well as humanitarian aid for civilians in conflict zones like Gaza. And another $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific region, where Taiwan continues readiness exercises should China invade. The legislation now moves to the Senate, where a vote should come early this week, advancing the measure to U.S. President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Not surprisingly, news of the bill's passage was well received in Kyiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for efforts to reduce to a minimum the time between political decisions to provide military aid to Ukraine and enabling the country's soldiers. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv joins VOA's Steve Miller.
Anna, we heard from President Zelensky, but how are other people reacting to the passage of this House bill?
Definitely, it was an extremely positive vibe when the vote passed. I can say that I think that it was probably the first time in Ukrainian history that a lot of Ukrainians were watching live the U.S. Congress session. And definitely people were extremely excited about that and really hopeful that the approval will be happening. So a lot of people in Ukraine and discussed a lot that everyone, they have fears about this, you know, talks about the future new Russian assault. There is also information about extreme shortage of ammunition at the battlefield, at the front line. So definitely this approval of this package, definitely Ukrainians feel that this package will, you know, give a lot of possibilities to Ukraine, not only to repel this future assault, but even maybe at some areas of the front line to get more success.
And really quickly, in the time that we have left, Anna, I believe the Ukrainian military has confirmed a strike in Sevastopol.
The Russian ship called the Komuna was hit, and this is Russian supply ship for the Black Sea Fleet of the Russian Federation. And Ukrainian authorities said that it's still to be clarified the amount of damage and the level of damage. But according to preliminary information, the ship is no longer operational. This is not a combat ship. However, this ship is important for Russian Black Sea Fleet. In particular, it was used to survey the place where the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet Moskva sank. So basically it was quite, used quite a lot by the Russian forces. So at this point, this is what we have.
Anna Chernikova reports for VOA from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, as always, we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Steve.
That's VOA's Steve Miller speaking with Kyiv correspondent Anna Chernikova. Of all the bills that passed over the weekend, the one for Ukraine was the most controversial. Some right-wing Republicans have threatened to remove Speaker Johnson from his post if he went forward with the vote. For a look at the politics behind it all, I'm joined by Katerina Lisunova. She's the congressional reporter for VOA's Ukrainian service. So what was it like in the Capitol over the weekend when the bill passed? It was an overwhelming victory. I think all Democrats and most Republicans voted for it. Was there a sense of relief, a sense of joy and happiness that this finally got done?
Yes, it was. There were a lot of conversations about historical moment, about Nevin Chamberlain and Churchill, about how history will judge this moment. And actually was a part of answer of Speaker when I asked him about, was it timely, was it in a proper time, the date passed, or it took too long, what is his opinion? He said that history will judge it well. And there was a sentiment that it is a historical moment, which took actually longer than it should, but the fact that it passes got a lot of, I would say, pure joy and happiness from many Democrats and Republicans.
So a wide range of economic military assistance. This is something that Ukraine has been asking for a long time. It's something that most American politicians and certainly a majority of American voters are in support of. Why did it take Speaker Johnson so long to get this to where it is now, to get this to a vote?
It's a very good question. And actually, I've been able to address this question to Johnson just after the hearings, the vote at the House. I asked him, I said literally that it was a brave step for him because he literally right now jeopardizing his work because there are far-right Republicans who are calling for his resignation because of this bill, because of this aid. But in the same time, he decided to do that. But in the world, among European countries, among Ukrainians and many others, and Americans as well, there are questions why it took so long to do that. If referring to his answer, he said that House had a lot of work to do, specifically funding the government of the United States. There were bills which were more on the first priority for House to pass. And that was the reason, at least from his words, why it took longer than it should have. But we also need to recognize the fact that House had a lot of troubles right now, turmoil. What changed his mind to pass this bill right now? It's still a little bit of a question, and he didn't provide a clear answer to that. But before this vote this Saturday, technically 2 weeks ago, Congress went to recess, I also asked him when exactly he's planning to bring aid to Ukraine on the floor. And he said just after government would get funding, because this is the main priority. And technically, he did how he said. He made the main priority to fund the United States government. And after that, he brought this bill to the floor.
So you told us just a moment ago that some on the far right of the Republican Party are not happy that this bill came to the floor and would be happy to see Johnson removed from his job, notably Marjorie Taylor Greene. How likely do you think that is to happen?
It's a very good question, because technically motion to vacate the speaker was brought by Marjorie Taylor Greene, but she needed Republicans to support that, because they have very narrow majority. At least three Republicans are enough right now to bring this question to the floor. And if all Democrats will vote in favor of ousting the speaker, and these three Republicans will join them, it would be enough votes to actually fire speaker from his job. Right now, Marjorie Taylor Greene actually has two people who joined her call to ouster the speaker. It's Congressman Massey and Gosar. I actually talked to one of them, Congressman Massey, and I was asking him what is the plan, why exactly do they want to do that. So far, they are not bringing this motion to vacate speaker on the floor. What they want to do, they calling for speaker to resign himself. Technically, they're using this motion to vacate a speaker as a leverage, as a pressure on the speaker. They're not bringing it to the floor. They're calling for him to resign by himself, to make this choice, this decision by himself. And technically, right now, it's a way of pressuring and make attention on the speaker. We'll see how it's going to go, how it's going to work. But also, I talked to a few Democrats who already told me that they are ready to technically save Speaker from this motion to vacate and vote against his ouster.
Katerina Lisanova is VOA's Ukrainian Services congressional reporter following what is no doubt a very busy weekend. Katerina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A community in Pakistan has figured out how to monetize climate change. We'll get that story in a moment. First, though, Israel and another look at this past weekend's action in Washington. Along with aid for Ukraine, the House of Representatives has passed aid for Israel. The top military intelligence officer has resigned, and some IDF battalions are facing sanctions for human rights abuses, and Passover starts tonight. I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, you know, this aid package comes amid quite a lot of tension between the U.S. and Israel over the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and President Biden warning Israel against going into the southern city of Rafah, which Israel seems determined to do, if not immediately. So I think a lot of Israelis are seeing it as kind of a sort of you know, intensifying the ties between the U.S. and Israel, showing the world that the U.S. still supports Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu said, you know, thank you, America. Thank you, President Biden. The chief of staff said it shows that the United States has Israel's back and that the United States and Israel are united in the region against Iran. So it's definitely being welcomed here.
But there is sort of a mixed message, as the U.S. is also talking about putting sanctions on one of the Israeli military battalions.
Yes, so that's the Netzach Yehuda battalion, which was made of supposedly ultra-Orthodox soldiers, although most of the soldiers are not actually ultra-Orthodox. They're either people who've left the ultra-Orthodox faith or, you know, the more sort of right-wing religious battalions. And there have been several deaths of Palestinians when they were supposedly already had been subdued. So it's not clear exactly what the U.S. sanctions would mean in practice, but it's certainly kind of a slap in the face to Israel, and it's a warning. So I think you're right that there's this kind of, on one hand, very strong support for Israel, talking about billions of dollars in aid that will allow Israel to refresh its supplies of Iron Dome anti-missile technology. It calls for investigating new technologies, but at the same time, kind of a warning to Israel that the United States is sort of watching carefully what's happening in the Israeli army.
And staying with the theme of the Israeli military, the top military intelligence official has resigned following criticism after October 7th. Can you tell us who he is, why he might have resigned,
the
backstory there?
Sure. His name is Aharon Haliva. He's actually been in the army for 38 years. And soon after October 7th, several of the senior officials, including Haliva, including the head of the Shin Bet, including the chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, had said that they feel they bear responsibility for what happened on October 7th, which, however you look at it, is a huge intelligence failure. How did they not prepare in a better manner for a potential Hamas attack? Why were there so few soldiers? Why was Hamas able to overrun more than 20 communities and kill 1,200 people and take 250 hostage? By the way, 133 of them are still being held hostage, which is a big deal in terms of Passover and freedom. But so I think he's the first senior official to say he's resigning. He said he'll wait until he's replaced. But the army has just started probing, looking into what happened on October 7th, and it seems likely that this is just the first of quite a few. And Israeli analysts have noted that the one significant person who has not accepted any kind of responsibility is the Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Well, I think you answered my next question for me. This is the first high-level resignation. Will there be more?
I think there definitely will be more. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that the chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, will stay on, the head of the Shin Bet. I mean, there were so many mistakes made and so many sort of, you know, misconceptions of what Hamas was up to. I mean, remember, you know, Israel and Hamas are still in a war 6 months later. But for a lot of Israelis, you know, it's still October 7th. I was listening a lot to the radio today as, you know, preparing for the holiday of Passover, and which is the, you know, holiday of freedom. And, you know, you had all of these relatives of hostages speaking, and their life is just, you know, awful. And they just are so sad about what's happening. And a lot of Israelis all over, I think actually a lot of Jews, are going to have empty chairs at their table representing a hostage. I know the Seder that we're going to, that my brother-in-law is leading, he asked each of us, he leads sort of the big Seder for the kibbutz, and he asked each family to come and to sort of present a hostage who they either knew personally or had read about. And we're going to have empty chairs at the table with their picture. In our case, it's going to be a young man who my son, my 23-year-old son, knows, and he wants to talk about him. And so it's sort of, I think for Israelis, for many Israelis, it's still October 7th.
And we'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
And finally today, as mangrove forests shrink every year around the world, Mangrove cover in Pakistan has increased nearly three times since the mid-1980s. The country's efforts to boost its mangrove cover is paying off, and Pakistan is now making millions in the global carbon credit trading market. But frequent political changes are keeping Pakistan from utilizing the funds to strengthen its own defense against climate change. VOA's Pakistan bureau chief, Sarah Zaman, traveled deep into the Indus River Delta and has the story.
They say money doesn't grow on trees, but in the Indus River Delta region of Pakistan's southern province Sindh, mangroves are making millions. The trees are a natural shield against planet-warming carbon emissions. Mohammad Khan Jamali is a field officer with the Sindh Forest Department.
They absorb four times more carbon than the ordinary tree. Their roots first grow below their ground and then grow out. They have more mass below ground and absorb more carbon even in the soil.
That makes mangroves valuable in carbon trading markets, where individuals, companies and countries buy credits to compensate for their greenhouse gas emissions. To harness mangroves' money-making potential, the Sindh government launched the Delta Blue Carbon, or DBC1, project in 2015 with a private partner, Indus Delta Capital. DBC1 is a 60-year project to protect and expand mangrove forest over 350,000 hectares and sell carbon credits generated through them. So far, the project has earned some $40 million in carbon credit sales. Fatma Bibi is among hundreds of locals making a living through mangrove seed collection and planting.
My uncle has a huge boat. We all get into that boat and go to the forest and gather seeds. We make a decent living.
The Sindh government gets 40% of DBC1's carbon credit earnings, according to Divisional Forest Officer Shehzad Sadiq Gill. That's a hefty $14 million after taxes so far.
Other ecosystems
will be used on other ecosystems in Sindh. It can be used for mangroves. We also have riverine ecosystem, inland forest, social forestry, rangelands.
There's a huge potential.
The Sindh government can also use the money for other public services. But Gill says the funds are still sitting idle in the provincial government's account. That's largely because of a lack of decision-making, driven by political instability. Severe weather that officials blame on global warming continues to wreak havoc. But political instability has also left Pakistan without a national carbon trading policy. Critics say that deprives the country of much-needed income to strengthen defense against climate change. In January, Asif Haider Shah, then Secretary of the Ministry of Climate Change, told VOA the framework was ready.
It has taken a couple of years. The biggest challenge was capacity and a lack of clarity also.
But a new government that came in March has not said when it'll roll out the policy. Opponents of carbon trading allege it lets polluters pass the buck. But proponents like Karachi-based ecologist Rafiul Haq say monetizing climate change mitigation efforts helps engage communities.
If you put it a tag value, an incentive value, the consistency would automatically come out. And that's happening with the carbon credit project.
In August 2023, Sindh government launched DBC2. That project covers 250,000 hectares of land. The Indus River Delta is spread over 670,000 hectares. Officials hope to have mangrove forest across much of it by 2030. Earnings from carbon credit sales will fund that effort. That means the trees will pay for themselves while helping Pakistan's earnings grow. Sarah Zaman, VOA News, KT Bandar, Sindh, Pakistan.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.